now for Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ertz.
Welcome on in today to IUP Plus. This is our News for Utah Plus streaming show where we take Inside Utah Politics, hence the term IUP, and we go deeper. We go beyond the headlines and bring in analysts to break down the biggest Utah political news and national news that is going on at the current moment. I want to welcome my analysts today, Leah Murray and Aaron Ryder. Hi, ladies.
Hello.
Hi.
Good to be with you. Introduce yourselves. Tell us who you are.
I'm Leah Murray, political science professor up at Weber State University and the director of the Walker Institute.
And I'm Aaron Ryder. I'm a local attorney, former GOP candidate, and currently, I guess we can now announce it, Lindsay.
Right, let's go.
I know. Long, long wait. I am the director of the HOA Ombudsman Office of the Department of Commerce.
So that means that if you have an HOA problem butting up against state law, Aaron's
right.
Your girl.
Come to me.
That's who you call. Producer Peter's here as well. Hi, Producer Peter.
Hi, I sure am. I have an equally sized box, and I'm ready to go.
If you're watching this video, we have a new format. We're all in boxes instead of, we're all sitting at the same table together. So if we like look weird and, do that, that's why. Producer Peter, appreciate you dressing up today.
Oh, well, thank you. I've got my concert tee. I've got basketball shorts, flip flops for, late summer, and I'm ready to get going. Those of you, I want to give a quick production note. Those of you who watched our Tuesday program, I think I've got it down to a science now. Our new boxes. We're ready to rock and roll.
Let's go. We're in it. All right. Appreciate it. All right. We got to hit a lot of things today. There's plenty to talk about here in the great state of Utah. First, I want to kind of talk about the remnants of the Charlie Kirk situation and specifically kind of the handling of the case. Leah and Aaron, I want you to sort of talk about the FBI's handling of this case. We know that Kash Patel and some of his deputies came into Utah, really sort of, tried to make this was a federal issue on top of being a local and state issue. But we saw some kind of, I guess you could call them missteps with the FBI, although the FBI doesn't believe they're missteps. And recently, Kash Patel was in front of a Senate committee having to defend himself for this very thing. Let's take a listen. Sorry, Peter, I put you on the spot.
Announcement that the suspect was in custody. We got our man. It turned out that was not true. In fact, I think that was about 27 hours before the person now in custody was apprehended. Why did you make that statement?
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate you letting me address this. What the FBI does is not just locate and find suspects, but we also participate in eliminating subjects. And what we had at the time was a subject in custody in relation to this investigation. So in my commitment to work with the public to help identify subjects and suspects, I put that information out. And then when we interviewed him, I put out the results of that. And could I have been more careful in my verbiage and included a subject instead of subject? Sure, in the heat of the moment, but I was doing the best I could.
In all candor, I don't quite get that, because if we have our man, that would suggest to the public that everybody can rest and relax and not then continue to provide information to the local law enforcement and to you. Well, so that was a mistake.
I don't see it as a mistake. I see it as something working with the public to identify that there was a subject in custody.
If you put out a statement that says we've got our man, and in fact it turns out that you didn't have your man, that's not a mistake?
But that's not what I said.
So... Okay, so there you go. That is how Kash Patel was defending himself in front of the Senate. Ladies, your take here. How did the FBI do handling this case, in your opinion?
Well, a little bit, I just want to say, I absolutely agree with the senator there that when we were initially told they had caught a subject, I did not catch the nuance that maybe it was just we think we have a subject. I actually thought we have the person in custody. And the texts that were going back and forth between myself and other people who work on college campuses, all of whom were very scared last week, felt like, oh, thank goodness, we actually have the subject and we can all kind of relax. And then to find out, oh, no, we don't. And then it wasn't even just the first time. They actually then claimed they had another person in custody. So that we all were like, oh, now they have it. Oh, no, we don't. And a little bit that was, added to the turmoil, if that makes sense, like made that day harder.
So yeah. Your perspective, sorry, Aaron, did Kash Patel handle that the right way?
I don't think so. I mean, or the point is, if he thought he was giving the public information that made us pay more attention by saying that they had caught somebody, I'm not sure he achieved his goal.
Sure. Aaron, go ahead.
I think this highlights the difficulty of communicating in a situation like this in a world of the internet and in a world of social media, because there was so much flying out there all over the place, so much information. Most of it was wrong. And then to have the FBI on top of that saying, we've got a guy. Oh, he's not the guy. Well, we've got a guy. Well, he's not the guy. Like, that doesn't actually help. It just breeds more misinformation. It breeds more of the, like, I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's going on. Maybe Kash Patel didn't appreciate that going into this. And the nuance of using a word like we have a person in custody instead of we have the person in custody, that's going to get lost in the social media world, right? So if anything, I think this highlights that if a situation like this were to arise again, then we need the FBI, we need the people in charge of this to be a little bit more mindful, maybe a lot more mindful about how they're going to run this investigation. Because to me, it looked like the FBI didn't have a clue what they were doing, and they were kind of running around like chickens with their heads cut off. Whereas you had, and that was contrasted next to someone like Governor Cox, who looked so poised and so confident and so in charge throughout that entire process. And Kash Patel did not convey that. And that's not what you want from the guy who's running the FBI.
Yeah, so the other issue here is Patel says that at his direction, they released the photos of the suspect. And we now know, according to prosecutors, that it was the suspect's mother who identified him from those photos. So one could argue that if it's true that at his direction he did that, that was very helpful in catching the subject. Do you guys see it that way, or how do you see it?
I mean, a little bit, and I'll just be flip. My response was it was family and local law enforcement that managed this whole case, and a little bit, and I did say that. So I have colleagues who teach crime scene investigation, and I said something flip like that, right? The FBI wasn't helpful at all. And they said, no. To be fair, resources were brought in, right? And the way that they manage investigating the crime scene, all of that was helpful. All of that was important. So I want to like dial back my own feelings about it. I thought, this is local law enforcement. The FBI didn't help at all. I'm not sure Kash Patel helped at all.
Yeah, I think that's actually a pretty good way to say it. It looked like Kash Patel didn't know what he was doing and that he was out of his league very quickly. Maybe that's not true, but that's certainly how it appeared. And I think the FBI was helpful. I think that the decision to release those photos, if that came at the direction of the FBI, great. I mean, if that's part of what helped lead to the capture of, you know, the suspect, great, then that's terrific. And that's what we really, you know, that's the outcome that we needed. But it didn't look like Kash Patel knew what he was doing.
So it's not just the Charlie Kirk situation Patel was grilled about from senators. There's also issues of firings within the FBI and some of his other handlings of high profile things. Do you guys think anything happens to Kash Patel in the wake of sort of all of these situations that he's dealing with?
I don't know, right?
Yeah,
a little
know.
Bit. So I would be very wary of trying to predict Trump administration officials. I do think some of them last longer than I would expect, right? Based on things that we see, and others of them get fired in ways I wasn't expecting. Like, I would not have predicted how quickly Elon Musk left that administration, right? So a little bit, I want to say, I don't know that answer.
Yeah, I think the fact that we ultimately have the guy or who were, you know, innocent and
the suspect, you know, the alleged killer.
The suspect, right. Yep. But if we have the guy at this point, if it feels like it's more or less wrapped up and that the FBI's role in this accomplished what needed to be done, I don't know that there's much. It's sort of the end of the story in that sense, right? Like, it's different than if this dragged on for months and months and months and the FBI was just bungling things all over the place. So I don't know.
Okay, so some very I don't know answers there. No one wants to take a position.
Like Leah said, it's hard to predict. I mean, you never know where this is going to go.
Peter, chime in here.
For what it's worth, just to offer some context from the administration's point of view, President Trump was asked about this on Monday. Granted, that was prior to this Senate hearing, but his statement at that time was that he has full confidence in Director Patel and, in fact, applauded him for the timeline that the shooter was brought into custody. He said it easily could have taken 4 or 5 days. He was very impressed with that 33-hour figure.
Well, there we go. Okay, I guess we'll leave it there for today. Something else related to the Charlie Kirk shooting that I wanted to bring up was right here in our own backyard, a state senator from the good city of Riverton, Dan McKay, is raising money for a memorial on UVU's campus. So, Leah, I'm going to start with you here because this is your wheelhouse. He's so far raised $75,000, according to his Twitter post, his X post, excuse me. But what happens if UVU doesn't want a memorial on their campus?
Oh, that is a really good question. I wasn't expecting you to ask that, Lindsay. So I think they will be accepting of a memorial on their campus, right? So generally, I think it is the case that this was a traumatic event. I want to like use the example. I went to Syracuse University back in like the 1980s. Students were killed when a plane was hijacked and was crashed, right? So that was a horrible thing that happened in Lockerbie, over Lockerbie, Scotland. They built a memorial. And to this day, when you go on that campus, you can stop there. They honor those students. They honor the day that that collective kind of community tragedy happened. So a little bit, I think UVU, this is a collective community tragedy that happened on that campus. Having some kind of memorial helps heal, right? Honors that, lets students today and future students kind of be aware of what happened to their community. So I don't think they're going to say no.
Okay, so let me just push you a little bit. Does he have to get permission from the university though?
Yes, so what he would do is work. Oh, that's a good question. It depends on what capacity he's doing in it, right? So if he is a legislator, maybe the legislature can just tell, you know, the university answers to them, this is where you're going to do this. I imagine more it's in the nature of a gift maybe, right? And so then they working with donors, working with the advancement office at UVU, figuring out where it will be placed, what it should look like, and all of that would be in cooperation with the campus.
So Aaron, do you agree that UVU will want this memorial? And I mean, what about the students on campus? Well, it's probably appropriate that they memorialize the tragedy that happened there. What if they didn't agree with Kirk's point of views?
Well, to Leah's point, I don't know that that's the main issue. I think the main issue is that this was a tragedy that happened on the campus. And, you know, no matter what, for many, many people, especially if you were a student on that campus, this would be an emotional time. Like, I don't know how you get around that. Like, it is an emotional time. Like Leah said, having a memorial, having something to acknowledge that can be very healing and can bring maybe in some ways a little bit of a sense of closure to something that was a very traumatic experience. So I think it's in some ways less about how you felt about Charlie Kirk's politics and more about the nature of the tragedy that happened.
And I think I might add, and I would just say too, I could have a different feeling about Charlie Kirk's politics and absolutely agree that what happened to him should not have happened.
Sure.
And that campuses are places where we should have a free marketplace of ideas.
Yeah.
Right. So I can memorialize the ending of free speech in that moment rather, mm-hmm. right? So the conversation can be about what we stand for as a campus is that people are safe to come here. People are safe to have conversations that might be different or difficult. And we are honoring that legacy as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's again, it is about Charlie Kirk, but it's about more than Charlie Kirk, maybe I'll say, and the feeling that we want people to be able to come to universities, and universities should be a place where we can have dialogue. And, you know, that's the thing that people are talking about Charlie Kirk about right now, right? That he did that. He went to those campuses and he engaged in that dialogue. A memorial on a campus in many ways feels perfectly fitting to what he was trying to do. And anyway.
Sorry to interrupt you. Should we use state money for this? I mean, this is a lawmaker who can petition his, you know, his fellow colleagues to try to get an appropriation for this. Should the state fund this memorial?
Man, that is a good question too,
that's
Lindsay.
I'm full of them today.
Well, and I think it's a little bit interesting that we have a fundraiser, a private fundraiser going on right now, because I think that makes this a little bit trickier that you have a state lawmaker who's kind of driving a private fundraiser to put a memorial on a state school. That seems a little bit strange to me. Like if people want it, then, and if the legislature wants it there, let's go through the process. Let's, you know, we have a legislative session coming up, certainly a time when we could have that conversation. or go the route of making it a private donation. And, but I don't know, it feels like this, we're sort of crossing into two different territories, and I don't know.
Yeah. And it's a legitimate question I have. Does the state have to approve what goes on UVU's campus?
I mean,
guys,
this is,
I'm full of them today. I know
you are full of them. You are full of them. I think that, you know, this is not my area of expertise, but if the legislature wanted to direct the school, I think that's a different question than, you know, does the school have to get permission to do it?
Yeah. And I guess I would add, so just to the conversation, it didn't just happen. I mean, it happened at UVU, but it happened to the state of Utah.
Yeah.
And as someone who has been on a campus for the last week, my students held a vigil last night. 250 people came to that vigil. This is also a collective community of the state of Utah. So to a certain extent, to answer your question, I'm not going to like address whether funds, you know, funding streams should mix. But to a certain extent, if the state wanted to say, we want to honor something that happened in the state that was collectively tragic, then I don't know that I have a problem, right, with them directing state funds in that regard. So I think, however it happens, probably I think it's okay.
Okay. Well, we shall see. Now, there's no indication yet that Dan McKay is going to take state money. It's a question I would have for him. And I've sort of jokingly asked him via text before, but he declined to answer. So I actually, fun fact about this story, he was talking with some of these private donors on a kind of secret Twitter chat, but it was a public Twitter chat, and I got notified of it. And so I just jumped on and I heard him talking about kind of the what he wanted to do. And so then I texted him in jest and said, ha, I know what you want to do here. And he was like, okay, cool. What do I do with this information? So anyways, we will check in with the good state Senator Dan McKay and see what he wants to do here. Okay, you guys, let's switch topics to a major issue in our state, which is redistricting. And as we speak today, we now know who is on the legislature's redistricting committee. And we also know how they are, when they are going to meet to kind of discuss these maps. And the answer is they'll have two public meetings, Monday and Wednesday next week. If you're watching this at the, you know, as of this Thursday, they'll meet Monday and Wednesday next week. And then by Thursday, we will have maps. There's a 10-day public comment period after that where people can weigh in on the maps. And then October 6th, there is a special session, which I reported days ago, by the way, that... the legislature will vote on which map they then send to the judge to get approval to make sure that it followed the criteria of Proposition 4, which was an anti-gerrymandering voter-approved initiative. So, ladies, with all of that as the background, what do you expect to see next week?
Excellent maps.
What does excellent mean, dear professor?
I want there to be a district that allows kind of the Wasatch Front to have some representation, and then some districts that allow our rural areas to have representation.
So well, that a little is different bit, than what we have right now.
Yes, I am rooting for, what are we calling it? The donut.
I don't think we're getting a donut, but Aaron, what do you think?
I don't think we're getting, here's the thing. No matter how they draw these maps, somebody's going to be mad. There is no way, like, gerrymandering generally is a problem, but also on a meta level, it's sort of like, how do you ever get around it? Because someone somewhere has to decide how to draw these maps. Like, someone has to make this decision. And the issue here is that the courts felt like the legislature didn't follow the process that they should have followed to do it. So now we're going back to the drawing board, literally. But does that, I don't know how much that really changes what these maps are going to look like. Because, I mean, honestly, having a rural-urban split in the districts is not an illegitimate way to set up these districts. It is a valid way to do it, to make sure that the rural and the urban folks both have representation and a voice in Congress. That is a legitimate way to split up these districts. Does it cut out the powerhouse of Salt Lake County? Yeah, sure. Of course it does. But also, if you just draw the map to give Salt Lake County its own congressional district, well, how is that in some ways any different, yeah, right? You're just sort of choosing, you kind of have to just
gerrymander.
Yeah,
for,
right?
Yeah. Leah, make your case for the donut hole.
So the donut hole, I do apologize to my dear friend here who who lives in the Salt Lake area. What happens with the pizza wedges is it assumes that everything about politics and everything that's happening for our representation has something to do with Salt Lake City. And as someone who doesn't live in the city, someone who lives outside of Salt Lake City, I want to argue that some of us in the state have interests that are different and unique. And a little bit, the only one talking about it at the federal level is Celeste Malloy, Representative Celeste Malloy, because she's the only one who doesn't live here. I would love to see some districts that allowed representation, right, that had representatives from off the Wasatch Front. I think that would be an interesting add to our congressional delegation. And I don't even have to make it Democrat or Republican. It's just a rural-urban conversation that I think is missing.
Now, I think, just to clarify, doesn't Congressman Kennedy live in Utah County?
Well, he represents that area, but sure, presumably. But that's still the Wasatch Front, I think.
It is still the Wasatch Front, sure. All I'm saying, like your point, Leah, is certainly valid. But again, it comes down to how do you decide to split Utah into four relatively equal pieces? Like, what does that mean, right? How do you decide to who gets represented in what way? And as someone who does live in Salt Lake County, and I live very close to the border where all four of these districts connect, I mean, I could probably walk to the four corners of where all these things connect. There also is an argument to be made that Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County is not getting special representation by virtue of the fact that it's cut up into four pieces. Like, I don't feel that my representatives are putting any more effort into Salt Lake County than they are into the rural areas. In fact, when I ran for Congress in 2022, that was a big part of my campaign, is that my representative wasn't representing Salt Lake County
so
in any way, shape, or form.
Do you want that representation? To Leah's point, that's what she's saying. She wants that representation as someone who lives off of the Salt Lake City central area.
Well, what I'm saying is, I think it's interesting that Leah's point is, if we're not in Salt Lake County, we don't get represented. And my point is, but even if you're in Salt Lake County, you don't always feel like you're getting represented, which in some ways, maybe that means they're doing the job right, because everybody's sort of getting the same amount of attention, right? Again, like, no matter what, you have to decide how to split these groups into four. And with the majority of the population in the state being concentrated in the Wasatch Front, I don't know how you don't have the Wasatch Front split in some way where you've got some sort of rural urban dynamic.
Well, Leah, we have to wrap here, but just to your point, you know,
I'm right.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying the legislature.
That's
wants,
not the last
the
word.
Legislature argues that a pizza pie allows for some rural and some urban because we're all so interconnected, right? Our water issues impact
right.
Salt Lake.
I What's totally respect that, and the United States Senate does that job. So we have two senators who represent the entire state that have both the rural and the urban inside of their districts. House representation does not have to be like that. It should be more locally, I think, should be more locally designed.
Well, we will see what comes out next Thursday. Make sure you stay with us here on IUP Plus, because we will break down these maps, probably put them on a big screen and break them down for you. So Leah Murray, Aaron Ryder, thank you so much for your perspectives today. Producer Peter, appreciate you.
And I always appreciate y'all. Thank
it
you so much.
Good to be with
for doing
you.
The heavy lifting here. I get to sit pretty.
Listen, none of us know how to push the buttons, so we need you. Let's just put it that way. All right. We will see you next time. Yeah.